Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Rowntree. I'm head of content at ExchangeWire. I'm joined once again by our CEO, Kieran O'Kane. Welcome.
Hello, Lindsay.
Lovely to have you here, as always.
It's emotional. It's always emotional.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And delighted to have our special guest today is Lauren Dick, who is Director of Business Development at Mail Metro Media. Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Lovely to have you here. So let's kick off with our three big stories. I mean, one probably needs very little introduction. It is the news, hold the front page. Is it news or is it something everybody expected? That Google has announced they will be killing off third-party cookies within a two-year window. We can go into details. I actually probably don't think I'm going to bother going into details of what they're actually doing. It's obvious they're following in Apple's footsteps. Apple, obviously, with ITP. But Google wants to make sure that they are in a position where within 2 years' time, they can denigrate third-party cookies and not allow the more nefarious characters within the ad tech world to play with workarounds, something that Apple's been struggling with its various iterations of ITP over the past couple of years. So it's big news. Some are saying is this the evolution of the necessary evolution of ad tech, of the advertising ecosystem? Is it RIP programmatic? Is it RIP attribution and measurement? What do we think? I mean, also 2 years on the one hand is a long time, but Lauren, we were just talking beforehand, not that long a time actually, when it means you have to rewrite everything and understand how your business model changes. But also there are many companies that will not survive this. So does a two-year window mean they're sitting there now going, well, what do I do? Do I shut down now? Do I wait 2 years? Do I try and pivot? There's a lot of unanswered questions. Kieran, I'm going to come to you, and you're on a tight leash when it comes to how much of a rant you're going to go on.
I'm not going to rant because I told you so. I said it in a post before Christmas. I said I told you so, and it's happened. And why are we all surprised? Look, Google have used this to their, they are the great Machiavellian company of our time. They've used privacy as a way to push their own agenda, right? So, Firefox has gone down the route of a no third-party cookie policy, as has Safari. Now, Chrome is an integral part of Google's future in terms of the Stadia rollout, which is the streaming gaming thing.
Stadia.
Stadia is obviously a brand of some sort. I can't remember what it was.
Is it?
Yeah. So Stadia is their sort of streaming gaming service, right? So they're going to protect Chrome at every turn because it's integral to a huge growth area for their business. Look, there's a few things here. TCF is dead. It's a waste of time. I told you so. The IAB is better off not talking to the ICO now. Finish that. That's just a waste of time. Because why would you do? What's the value of it now if Google say no more third-party cookies? Right? That's just obvious. Display has to be completely rethought about. The DR display, the cookie window, the view through, that's gone as well, right? So we're going to go back to context. I think this plays into Lauren's sort of positive offering from the Mail and other properties, that they are a context-rich and a scale premium publisher. I think there's going to be money flowing back to the publishers in sort of contextual-only buys. We're going to see... I think trading teams at the holding groups and other agencies are going to start to wither away because programmatic display in the open market becomes almost impossible. It just becomes impossible.
So focus will go from the trading
to the planning teams
to the planning teams or to the IO teams, because yes. Don't forget a lot of these still have IO teams.
Yes, there's going to be an aggressive swing back to IOs. It's inevitable, right? And that means that the ad tech infrastructure is going to change radically. If you step back from the noise and the maelstrom and you actually have a proper look at this, you start to argue, so why am I paying 20% for a DSP to execute a matching ID when I can't match any IDs, right? And to that point, why would I need SSP to do the same thing when a holding group rings Lauren and says, I want to have a deal, I want to work on a context basis, and here's an IO, right? So there's going to be a lot of that. On the flip side, there's going to be a whole new bunch of companies doing contextual and probabilistic stuff, which I think is very exciting. So, while this is a disaster in some respect, and some people are surprised by this, I don't know why, it's quite exciting because it gives ad tech the kick in the arse it requires to kind of innovate. So that's it. That's all I have to say.
That's Dave, with some interesting points you put forward there.
Lauren, but I don't blame Google, by the way.
Okay. Well, it's I guess, necessary force of evil what has to happen for them to keep their business.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
And the fact that Google have given the industry 2 years is cover for them on the whole anti-competitive stuff. Like, the thing is, right, if you think about it this way, right, Google are between a rock and a hard place. And I'm going to give Google some sort of credence here, right? They have to, you know, they have to comply to the privacy, the new privacy norms, which means that people, users like us on the web, deserve to control our own privacy, right? So they're just building that functionality into Chrome, and I think it's probably something they have to do. Because if they don't do it, they'll lose market share to Safari and to Firefox. And that doesn't fit well with Google's grand plans around what Chrome can do in the future. And display advertising for them is just a rounding error. It really doesn't matter. Google make all the money on Google.com, YouTube. That's where they make the real margin, because they don't have to give 70 or 80% away to a publisher.
Well, I think from a consumer perspective as well, like, consumers might be lauding the fact that it's increased privacy for them. I imagine many won't even know what that actually means or what that's doing. But what they will be delighted about will be the reduced use of cookie warnings on sites. Probably the most important thing here, because that's the one thing that drives everyone mad. Mm. But yeah, again, is it really about user privacy, or is it about serving your own needs?
Are you talking about from a Google perspective?
Yeah. Well, I guess it is. Lauren, I'm interested in your perspective. Did you fall over in shock when you read the news, or did you see it coming?
I don't think it's completely shocking. I think that they've kind of been building up to this, and a lot of their conversations around the whole privacy sandbox have been kind of building up to what this could look like. And as you've already said, there was a precedent from Apple. It makes complete sense for their business. I definitely agree that there will be a kind of short-term swing to context and kind of other ways to target. I think that the IDs and the probabilistic kind of technologies that are out there at the moment is a really interesting space. And I think that what this really means, what yesterday kind of really means, is that where these have been kind of pocket tests or kind of very conceptual things that we're discussing, or very easy to minimize the impact because it's isolated to specific browsers, not Chrome, it's been very easy to kind of put these like slightly down in the priority list, whereas the announcement from Google really is a call to arms to the whole industry to actually say, no, this is a priority. We need to focus on what these alternative looks like. And to your point, 2 years is actually then not very long if there needs to be kind of a rewriting of the language that we use, or a change in the whole infrastructure that we're currently, or it will cause huge casualties. And there'll be a lot of businesses that don't kind of see that through if they're not kind of fast enough to stay ahead of what's happening and to evolve their businesses. I think on the CMP piece, that will also be an iterative it will be an evolution. Yeah. So where it's kind of cookie based right now, we'll see that move towards how can we have permissions for first party data, or how can we capture that in a slightly different way and being more explicit around the usage. But it will be an evolution, and I don't think there's been enough time from yesterday, or there has been enough clarity yet from the ICO on exactly what that looks like. So we're kind of back to being in this limbo of it remains to be seen exactly what that looks like.
It's the assumption phase. Exactly. Everyone's speculating what could happen, but no one really actually knowing, and everyone has their own opinions on what next phase could be. What were your thoughts on the hammering that Criteo took in the stock markets?
Oh, why would you be surprised?
Well, yeah.
Criteo's I can't believe Criteo's stock is not at $5, let alone 13.
It's around 13, isn't it? The lowest it's been in its history.
It's insane. Their entire business is based on retargeting. It's now impossible. I'd be shorting that stock something serious. I'm pretty sure it's the most shorted stock on the NASDAQ right now. Is it NASDAQ or the NYC? I don't know which one it is, but it's pretty much the most short stock possible. 2 years of revenue, okay. But what happens after that? I would say retargeting is probably responsible for a lot of this backlash against privacy. Let's be honest with you. Those ads just plague people, and ordinary people just saw those ads and then realised what was behind it. And I think a lot of that's propelled, even politicians who probably didn't even know about the space were compelled to act. So I suppose it's karma coming back to kick Criteo in the backside.
But I think that's true across more businesses than just Criteo. If you speak to anyone in the street and they say, oh, I spoke about something, or I was talking about it and then I was served an ad, that in itself is retargeting from various pixels across the internet, and we kind of all understand how that works. But that in itself is the bit that's creepy and has led to the position that we're in now, which
exactly.
is how are you using my identity and my data to profile me, and how is that being used to build these billion-dollar industries around it. And that's the bit that we're seeing the backlash to, the bombardment with things that are based on a profile that's potentially been erroneously built or used.
It's an interesting point. And I also want to ask you about what it actually means for the companies that will be able to get through this, the companies that it will impact the way they deal, the way they trade, but not necessarily impact what their core business is. So an agency is a good example. Trading teams, you think, will get rolled up into the planning teams, into the IO teams. It could mean redundancies. It could mean a shifting about of what they're working on. Also, it'll mean probably, do you think that it will mean there's less resource required in general to manage a campaign now? Because actually programmatic, from a resource perspective, kind of made things more complicated. Will it actually make managing, optimizing campaigns easier? Do they need the same level of people these companies have got at the moment?
I don't think so, because what we're going to see over the next decade is a streamlining of the agency process in terms of how they buy. So like I wrote a piece about the pie, you know, programmatic is everything. If you think all biddable media is programmatic, right? Then the complexity then becomes harder. You need skilled people to still trade, but not in a from a one dashboard rules them all, but from multiple dashboards, because the in-housing narrative really was all about the growth of programmatic display, right? That I'll bring it in-house because it's easier. Now it just becomes really difficult, because what happens now is we're going to go to walled garden territory, right? There's no ID that connects all those different walls,
so you're
right?
Managing a million multiple stakeholders.
Exactly. Anybody with first-party data is a winner, right? So I don't want to tell Lauren how to do her job, but I'd be trying to force people to log in. That's the first thing I'd be doing now as a sort of a newspaper publisher to get that first party. The good thing is about whether or not you opt them into advertising or targeting. Facebook is doing all the hard work for us. There's been a court case in Austria and a few other places where some data activists privacy activists have taken Facebook to court about, you know, the hard opt-in. How are you opting people into advertising when in the first party environment? Facebook's won that case. So it gives cover to everybody in the publishing world to roll out these services. But we're heading to a world where the open web effectively will be context only, right? It'll be machine learning context only, and that will be sort of like your long tail, sort of like, you know, sub maybe £1 CPM. And then the real margin will be made on any first party data. And that would be big margin business, less ads and page and big takeovers. And then you go back to creative as well. I think this is a very exciting sort of swing back from away from audience buying into this more creative, contextual, rich world. And there will be technology underpinning that, because you're still going to have to be able to work on a first party basis, like Superimative and InfoSum, all these guys doing some interesting stuff around data in a privacy first way. I think there's some exciting things happening, but the service there becomes even more important to the brands themselves, because how do you navigate this mess of audience that are completely fragmented? Okay, frequency capping, okay, measurement, that's a big problem in this space, but that'll be solved. I reckon we'll head towards a panel-based system like TV. We'll have to agree on that. I don't know who's going to run that, the IAB or somebody completely different, because I think after, we'll talk about the IAB in another episode, but they have their own problems now. That I think these are solvable problems, but it actually plays, there'll be a lot of short-term pain for publishers, but long-term, I think they're going to do really well out of this.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the people, there's not less people required. There's more people with slightly different skill sets. So more analysts, more kind of data modelling, data scientists, more developers, more people to actually build the underpinning of what the new open internet could look like. Yeah. So I definitely think that there is a huge opportunity on that side. And then to your point on the first party data, collecting it is one thing. Translating it and making it usable and getting away from price being the only thing that we had as a proxy for value and actually saying, well, this is what's valuable now is engagement. A huge reset that has to happen across the industry. And I think that that will be kind of the challenge in the here and now. However, there's a massive opportunity for not just digital, but this convergence with, we see TV has moved into kind of this automation space. There's been the global announcement on Tuesday this week. We'll see the same kind of moves from out of, especially with global moving kind of out of home into that piece. I think that we're at a point where if we're doing this and we're resetting what good looks like and how identity works across the digital ecosystem, we could actually do it across all media. So to your point on measurement and frequency capping, there's an opportunity to get this right across all media rather than it being...
Right.
or digital is the rod for digital's back is that everything is measurable, and then where there are pockets where you can't or something, it becomes very difficult. Actually, it's like, well, all media should be looked at in the same way. So is that panel based? Are there things that we can learn from other industries? So I didn't know about this until conversation yesterday, but there's like a quality score in outdoor from Root, which basically says it's like the quality of the screen and the quality of the position. What does a quality score look like for across everything?
If it's in a field with a load of cows, that's a low score.
Well, it would be, unless
if it's like really grainy.
What are cows your target market?
Well, if they're organic cows, I guess it would be higher up. But then if it was in a housing estate, like where I used to live, maybe not.
I see. Because there were no cows there.
No cows.
No.
Lots of concrete.
But it's getting the industry to all galvanise, and I mean the wider industry to galvanise around what's valuable, because it can't just be, oh, a cookie is worth this much.
Yeah.
And that's the only way that we determine value.
How do you corral that? That's a big job. How do you corral all of those people together? I suppose that comes.
So maybe an agency is quite well placed to do that because they have a finger into each of those pies from a media perspective.
I think an attribution model.
What cottage industry will this create? With every new development, it creates a new industry that didn't exist before.
I think
what will be created out of this?
I think there's probably a space for a really attribution focused agency that just focuses on like, it's almost like they're like a independent. It can't be related to the media. They just have to sit there and they're kind of brought in to make it work. Look, wherever there's chaos, there's going to be opportunity.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly,
at the minute,
exactly.
A lot of people are crying into their teas about the demise of the cookie, but it's been a long time coming. It was a really sort of flaky proxy built off the back of Google, and now Google said we've had enough. And that's the game over.
Yeah.
It's over, like, as far as I'm concerned. And I just find it, you know, these conversations with the ICO that the IB are having, you know, just give up.
They will become less relevant. They're basically irrelevant conversations that no one has to really kind of take as much notice in anymore, because it's effectively being done for them by Google.
Thank you, Google.
Yeah. Hey, it makes everyone's life easier. Why not?
I mean, I can see. I probably went
and
through the whole.
And moving back to a last click world. That's a great world to be in. Yeah. Everyone loves last click.
I mean,
come on.
Affiliate model is back.
Absolutely.
In. Absolutely. Those affiliate conferences are going to be class now.
Beautiful world.
It's interesting. There's a correlation between Criteo's revenue growth and the decline of affiliate. Now they're going to come back up now. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
tables have turned.
Yeah. It's amazing how things change and stay the same at the same time.
Probably a good note to move on to our next story. So the next is, at Exchanger recently, Sir Martin Sorrell.
Sir Marty.
Sir Marty.
Yeah, somebody calls him Sir Marty.
I didn't know it was SMS. That was the big revelation. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's such a great nickname.
I actually asked him on stage if I could call him Sir Marty. He said no, you cannot.
He said no.
Outright no. Yeah. Wasn't happy with that at all.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah.
Tino, maybe.
Timo.
That might have gone down.
Tino.
Tino.
No,
it wouldn't work.
You still like Sir Marty, don't you?
Yeah, I like Sir Marty.
Anyway, interview in iExchanger with Sir Marty.
Yeah.
Off the back of the announcement that they have made another acquisition.
Another one.
Surprise, surprise. Where they were announcing they were going to acquire Circus Marketing, which is a Mexico-based data-driven digital content agency. It'll be merged with their content arm of the business, which is Media Monks. Obviously, Mighty Hive is the activation side of the business. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. Within the interview, he talked about the fact that the way that we view media has to evolve. And gone are the days that, I'm going to refer to them as the Mad Men days. I hate that phrase, Mad Men, not Math Men or whatever it is. But his point is that that's not how business is done anymore. It's no longer about the big idea. That's not what wins pitches. What wins pitches, what wins clients and retains clients is the data and technology underpin it. And it's an interesting thought and perspective, particularly from the Media Monks, the S4 Capital perspective, is because they have that creative content side and they have the activation side. And they are trying to bring the two together, something that we talk about in many ATS events across the world. The big challenge is, how do you merge data and creativity? How does one inform the other? And just more generally, I guess, the opinions on, is it really, is the idea dead now? Does it matter what you're bringing to the table? What the creative idea, is that as important as it used to be versus the data and tech that underpin it? Lauren, I want to come to you first because you had some interesting thoughts about this.
Yeah, I think that he's absolutely right, that the big idea is kind of one element now, and there is still kind of good advertising needs to be like the right context and the right message, and the data and the technology that's available now, especially in digital, but actually across all media, allows us to be much more flexible with kind of testing what good looks like. But it's still more focused on like the delivery mechanisms rather than... you don't see as much in the kind of copy creative testing, but there is that opportunity. And I think that the more that the two kind of come together in terms of like the big standalone ideas, which are kind of creatively led, and then underpinning that with the insights from delivery, the insights, the frictionlessness that technology can provide, that's where we're starting to see this kind of winning point in the middle, like the convergence point in the middle, where both of those elements are, when they come together, that's what's winning pitches. And that's certainly kind of what we're seeing. But I think that if we kind of add the user into that element and the end consumer, they have a slightly different take on it themselves, in that advertising works when it's in exchange for something. So whether that's free content or whether that's kind of ad-funded models, and you see more and more things like Good Loop and programs like that. They just had a load of funding this week.
They have.
Where there's programs to actually say, well, advertising isn't all bad, and this is kind of the other stuff that it can generate from it. And all of that is kind of feeding back data in, underpinned by technology, and it starts to kind of feed out into the wider ecosystem how it can be used. And then on the completely opposite end of the scale, I think that there's a shift towards kind of the more subtle, this is how we're using data and technology in very, very above the line solutions. So things like this is an old example, but I always think of it, the Love Island water bottles. And actually the fact that Kieran's, they were able to put that into a program and everyone went so wild for it.
Genius.
And then they used all of the insights into like, well, what else was featured and what else were people buying off the back of it being in their TV show, so that the following year they had suitcases, they had sunglasses, they had, and all of that's from their search data, from their social data, to see like what is it that people are engaging with from
and
a
now
TV
they're
program.
Tied with their sponsors.
Exactly.
You can go on and you can buy the outfit of a particular violent contestant. That's all come from the original water bottle idea.
But now
it's using all of these new data points
to find out what
to
people,
find it right. and using technology. So whether it's kind of like literally very light touch e-commerce solutions to make that effective across mass audiences, rather than it being you saw that on TV and you had to go into a store to buy it, which is quite a clunky kind of user journey. We've basically put that into their phone.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What are your thoughts, Kieran?
I don't know. I mean,
Lawrence completely stumped him.
No, I think the product placement stuff is interesting. I mean, it's an old idea. It's like old wine and new bottles type thing.
But that's the point, isn't it?
Much of this industry is that.
But
does that mean, though, that, you know, Samarty saying that the big idea is no longer, it's still relevant, but it's no longer the main thing. I guess that's the point. Like, actually, in many cases, it could still be the main thing, depending on your approach to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the science now that we have behind the old ideas that make them even more relevant. I mean, then, like, think about it this way, like, you know, the streaming service like Netflix have a fairly sizable product placement business, which, you know, the products get into the likes of their top shows. Who was it? Stranger Things had a really cute conversation between two kids about Cherry Coke and Real Coke.
And I didn't even
think it was an advertiser until I realized that's advertising. Yeah. How dare they? But at the same time, kind of cool. But you know what I mean? All that is backed
up. But that's interesting in itself, because in this country, we have laws against HFSS, which is high fat, salt and sugar advertising on TV.
Yeah.
And actually, product placement then becomes a challenge for local regulations when it comes to global TV shows like Stranger Things.
But it's interesting that you talk about Love Island, and it's just people just they consume the ads in between the content because they have to, right? Or they, you know, some of the ads are quite good, but others are just, you know, just the usual spiritual car ads I don't understand at all. Like, you know,
spiritual car ads.
Their ads are really weird.
they're
kind of esoteric.
TV?
No, but they're really esoteric. Like, buy this car and you have this lifestyle. It's nonsense.
Everything's about lifestyle.
So yeah, but the fact of using the show as a vehicle to push these products, and the products are like functional within the show. Oh, here's my bottle. I'm really thirsty. I'm, like, oh, I'm thirsty too. Maybe I'll buy a bottle. You know what I mean? It's old school. I think we're swinging back. It's just like we try to reinvent the stuff all the time. I think
reinventing it using the information and the knowledge and the technology and data we have now. Yeah. So how can we make that thing better?
Exactly. It's less clunky and more finesse. And there's data analysts and data science figuring out where we put this at this time of the day and using this context, will we sell more of this product? And to your point, Lauren, how can we get this product in front of the user without them having to go through five layers of Amazon bullshit to get to the product, you know?
But it also removes marketing and media from being this kind of siloed bit of a business, because it's actually, well, this is fundamental to your sales, to your bottom line, and it kind of brings it back into for the end client.
Yeah,
it brings it back into something that's much more tangible, whether you're speaking to a CFO or a CEO, in terms of actually I can really see the power of this, and I can see it in hard data, and I can pull together a chart that shows me when I do X on Love Island, I sell this many bottles, or whatever it is, whatever your metrics are. So I think it's starting to make that marketing piece work a lot harder in bottom line business considerations.
I think we might start selling swag on Exchangeware, like cookie jars. Just come up with that idea. Like, you know,
Exchangeware cookie jars. I think
that's a great idea, actually, you know. And the hoodies as well. I like them as well.
Yeah, well, this is just merch, keep me warm, is massive. In my
so many podcasts.
It is. We should be like, we headle on that. And people love cookie jars. Especially with empty cookie jars.
People love cookie jars. I do have an Exchangeware bottle opener on my boiler, there of all
you
places.
Go. Yeah. There you go.
It's very useful. Yeah. Very useful.
But I am interested in his strategy. He keeps just buying companies and is layering on, like, you know, revenue. It feels like he's just talk about old wine and new bottles. It's sort of like WPP model 2.0. He just keeps buying businesses to increase the market cap. I understand the flannel and the positioning, but he's just basically replicating buying revenue effectively, which is interesting.
He is.
A billion interesting cap.
Yeah, exactly. But interesting you saying that about kind of old wine, new bottles, because a comment he made that I'll quote from the article was, there's an unwillingness among people in this industry to accept the importance of technology and the implications of that importance. I'm 74, about to be 75. I should be the last person on earth to understand that, but here I am.
He's 75? I thought he was 110. He's in good shape.
We might have to cut that bit out.
He looks great.
He does look great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Moving on.
Before he could spend with anybody here, yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly. Before we go to our third story, just on the topic of us talking about Exchangeware merch, just wanted to remind our loyal podcast listeners that ATS Stockholm is coming up on the 19th of February.
Yes.
We haven't been in that market for 8 years. We're very excited to be back. So obviously the usual expectations. We've got some great speakers, some great content. And for our loyal podcast listeners, we are offering a 20% discount if you use the code MADTECH, MADTECH. Just go to exchangewire.com/events to get 20% off your ticket. Moving on.
What a professional.
Thank you very much.
That was seamlessly integrated.
It's beautiful.
I'd be stumbling through that. I'd probably say a curse word in between.
People love your dulcet tones though, Kieran. Yeah, well. Anyway, third story. This is an interesting one, an exciting one. And for Lauren in particular, because she's obsessed apparently, so let's see what that means. So TikTok are to explore curated content feed to lure in advertisers.
What's TikTok?
We'll get into what TikTok is. Have you ever seen?
I've heard of the company.
Yeah. But so basically, they come under fire a lot about the brand safety on their platform. There is kind of illegal content. There's content that's kind of harmful to children, different audiences. And they seem to be unwilling, or they're not doing enough to regulate or moderate the content on their site. So they are looking to potentially go down the route of what Snap have done with Discover platform, which slow burner, but after 2 years has become a massive source of revenue for them, working with premium publishers and also luring in premium advertisers. TikTok could be looking to go and explore the same thing. So a separate curated feed, working with premium publishers, working with premium content creators on the site, whatever that means for TikTok. I know as much as you do, Kieran. But as a way of luring in advertisers in a much more brand safe environment. Lauren, it's come to you. Okay. What are your thoughts on this?
When I say I'm obsessed with TikTok, I'm obsessed with reading about it, and I'm a massive voyeur to watch people doing it.
It's fascinating. I don't understand. The concept baffles me that people would do what they do on TikTok. I don't get it.
It's like when you're... Well, so it's like me and my sisters doing like dance routines, but with someone's built an app to be like, actually, we can make this look really, really good.
Yeah.
And that's what that's all it reminds me of. So
with just some random music in the background.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. But
so
I find
it's like Britain Got Talent, but in a 15-second thing.
Well, no, because it could be anything. It's not even Britain's Got Talent. It could literally be anything to the background of a weird soundtrack.
Right.
And it could be a granny telling you over it. Yeah. You can loop it, so you can almost like create your own kind of GIF style content.
Yeah.
But no, in terms of what I'm obsessed with about it is like how quickly it's growing and how massive it's going to be, and it's coming to a market. Like you made the comparison to Snap, it's coming into a market with kind of the. It's obviously a Chinese funded. It's coming into new markets with all of the learnings from what Snap and others have done
and done wrong.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it can actually be like, so yes, okay, they can, the unsuitability of their content and some of the regulation, but I feel like there's a step change happening certainly in the last 6 months now in like who they're hiring, how they're bolstering kind of and adding some gravitas to their kind of business offering. Which will definitely kind of start to make them more and more of a feature of kind of for the advertisers to consider. So that bit, and if you think about Snap in the early days, they have come a long way from then as well. But it's more around like they're coming into this with learnings from a market like China and all the learnings from what everybody else has done wrong and can build from that point. So, for example, if they were to integrate Shop Now functionality straight in, do the WeChat model, but do that into something that's much more fun and video led, there's a huge, huge opportunity for them.
Shop Now.
What's as in, that? Like, pull in together kind of shopping and functionality of services from TikTok.
So all becoming a super utility app.
So you'd have an e-commerce engine backed into it then? Is that something Instagram was thinking about doing?
Yeah.
Sure,
but they're building on an existing platform. Ah. I'm saying that TikTok can almost API. Do that from scratch.
Mm. Mm. Interesting. I mean, it goes back to our previous, it's another walled garden, isn't it? Like, it's going to be massive. I mean, it's an opportunity for you guys as well. Like, it's another channel that's not Facebook. I mean, the more platforms available, the better, because Instagram are soaking up too much spend in the space, like Facebook. So it's another avenue for publishers to distribute, which is great because TikTok are really open and the revenue will probably be there as well. And you're not dealing with the brick wall of Facebook is like, and like Facebook relationship with publishers is awful. Let's be honest, they've just messed them over so many times around. What was the Instagram TV? What was their TV channel where they were buying content and then they kind of deleted the contracts? Was it Facebook TV?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they had a TV. They had like a YouTube type thing, and they were paying publishers to put content on the pit, and then they just decided
the Facebook not Facebook Live, but the TV platform. Yeah. That's right. Anyway, I forget the name of it. You're absolutely right.
They've got a bad rep anyway, but it's good to see. I guess TikTok's a bit, they've got lots of baggage as well. The fact that they're a Chinese company first and foremost it's highly likely they could be banned from the US. It could be like the IP could be blocked in the US.
It could be. They're trying to change their problems with India trying to ban them as well.
Yeah, they're trying not to be a Chinese
company.
They're not
popular.
Yeah, they're trying to divest the Chinese ownership into a global ownership. And I believe that Dublin and London and Singapore are the three cities that are on the map. I hope it's not Dublin because the house prices go through the roof if they end up in
Dublin.
They
already have that, haven't they?
Oh, they're
just
mental.
Completely unaffordable.
But you can see that they have baggage issues, but the fact that they can learn from all the mistakes of the previous incumbents. Like, Facebook, right, are not very good at innovating, right? Mark Zuckerberg built a message board for lunatics. Then he bought Instagram. Then he bought WhatsApp. He hasn't innovated in his entire life, right? So TikTok is like
but
a
there
whole
isn't
new
much,
level.
We talk about this often. There isn't much innovation in these companies. It's all bought.
And he's basically, they've created a new app called Lasso, which is basically a carbon copy of TikTok. And it has maybe 10 million users, which is a great business. I wish I had that. But it has no scale. And TikTok has sort of tapped into this whole next level of Gen Z sort of social media. It's more, I don't know, I've seen a couple of examples of it, and you're right, it's very interactive, very fun. It's just a different level of
well,
it's very creative. It's much more creative, I think. It's more tapping into the creative part of the brain.
But that uniqueness was exactly what made Snapchat so interesting when they first when they first launched. But it also makes it difficult to scale, kind of from an advertiser perspective. It's difficult to see that adoption be so quick because it's, you're not fitting into a standard model. Mm. You're actually saying, yeah, we need you to create unique content on the publisher side. We need this to be formatted in a certain way. It needs to be very native to our platform and what our users are already engaging with. And it needs to kind of speak to the users that we already have. So it's not something that automatically plugs into what already exists. So the curation part is, will be that first step to actually, we're going to have some kind of processes in place to pull this together, and this is what it will look like, and advertisers will follow, but there still will have to be a kind of step change in how we think about that platform and that and that distribution. It's not something you can be like, oh, I've got some content, so I'll just pop it on there as well.
But there's a life cycle with these platforms, you know what I mean? Like, you can argue that it's very sort of its time, isn't it, of its generation. So Snap now has to think about what do we look like in the next 10 years? Well, maybe it's just a messaging app for our existing generation, and hopefully people will use it because we add on to that. So TikTok is definitely Gen Z's new platform. So what happens when they grow up? Like, it's very fleeting, a lot of these platforms. And I suppose it's a bit of a headache for a content producer now, because they have to think about another platform and how it works and how it's the same.
I think life cycle...
But its scale is huge. Yeah, it could be absolutely massive.
Yes, but actually, probably more of a levelling out. Each of these apps goes through a hype when they first launch, and everyone tries to use them, and then it levels out to the kind of that one generation that makes it their thing, which is what we've seen on Snap. So yeah, it's leveled out, but it's still being heavily used by
users,
tweens,
yeah,
and 16-year-olds, and I don't know who uses Snapchat. Their user audience is very, very young.
Did they migrate to WhatsApp then after a while, or Telegram or some other?
Or their parents join and then they can't be seen to be using it anymore.
Absolutely. Or maybe they just stay on it. So Facebook is a growing, aging population.
There's this amazing audience stat about Facebook, and I can't remember where it's from, but it basically says that I'm pulling this date out of the air, but by 2030 they will be a mausoleum and I'll have more accounts of dead people than... I will have to find this.
That's genius. So it's basically a social graveyard.
Quite, because the profiles are getting older and older and older.
Oh, that's devastating.
You could have like a social funeral, so you wouldn't even have to bury the people anymore. We're just like online, and you pay they'll become like the undertakers of the internet. Like, that's a whole new business. If you listen, Mark, I'm very much up for running that business.
Consolidated to funeral companies.
Yeah, that's exactly
it.
I think
you could do well.
There's always money in dead people, let's put it that way.
That is an incredible stat. I love that. But yeah, so we think that what is the value of a TikTok type company coming from east to west? There are challenges that come with that we've already talked about. But actually, what are the benefits? Like, what can they bring to the Western market that, say, Western companies that try and go and do the same thing in China always fail to do?
But is there a bigger theme here? I don't know how you see it, but like the rise of K-pop, right? It's like,
well, true,
almost
yeah,
the APAC. Pacification, if you will, of culture globally. If that's not a war, that's a shit sort of term. But like, you know what I'm saying? There's more of acceptance of how Asia is such a trendsetter now. Like, the success of K-pop is mind-boggling. I don't get it at all, but people seem to love these people.
They really do.
I mean, these kids are...
You could go in on like a political and say, almost like as things thaw with the US, or as kind of that situation becomes more and more difficult politically, do we have to shift... further
east.
Or does
we
it make us, does it make us look
with,
better to, make, yeah. yeah it makes the east look much more appealing
maybe
I mean
that's
it's,
deep
it's the first Chinese company that kind of has had global scale. I know Alibaba, but this is the first real global success in Chinese business abroad, and obviously they want to be a global company. They don't want to be a Chinese company, because as you said, Lindsay, there'll be countries that said they're Chinese, let's block them. Like, India will probably... I don't know if you've seen... this is kind of going on a tangent, but Jeff Bezos has invested $1 billion into India, and all the merchants in India, the small traders, are going mental at the minute. So Modi might take a hard line against non-Indian companies who are kind of just disrupting his political base. So you're going to see a lot of this stuff. The geopolitical stuff is quite interesting from TikTok. From Manalo's perspective,
yeah,
it's just interesting how
is.
It's like, I couldn't care less about the media. I'm more interested in the fact it's been banned from the US, that many political leaders in the West think it's a spying tool for the Chinese government. The fact it is related to China. Are they just basically going to black? I mean, there's a Chinese company that was stopped buying Grindr. I don't know if you've seen that recently. They blocked the deal in the US for fear they might be able to blackmail military or local representatives in the US. That was actually blocked. Yeah, so you see, there's some interesting stuff. This story is bigger than just the media channel. I think the political undertones are fascinating.
I think that's what Lauren was saying, though. Fascinated by just everything TikTok is doing.
Yeah,
and
it's a story of our age.
Well, it is, and it's a Chinese company that is very much married in a Chinese way at the moment. Mm. If they want to become a real entity in the West and scale the way that they want to scale, much like a Western tech company or social platform wouldn't have, they'll have to change the way they operate their business as well. Can they remain a Chinese operations company in the way that their culture, their values operate? Will that have to kind of evolve as well?
If they take their headquarters in Singapore or Dublin or London, would they get a Western CEO, an American CEO or a British CEO or sort of anybody, you know, in the European or even Asian, non-Chinese? That could be quite interesting, because as you say, then does the mindset change to be in a global company? Because obviously they have huge ambitions. This could be an absolute runaway success. It could be as big as Facebook, if not more. And then obviously then it's the next stage. Once they get the success with TikTok, God, we have to buy more innovation. So they'll be looking around what companies can buy. If they're a Chinese company, the M&A could be blocked all over the place. So, you know, this is great. We could have a whole podcast on this.
Look how hot it is now.
Yeah. So, like you say, it remains to be seen, but I definitely think there'll be a shift to how they do their business if they want to be global and they want to work with the West. Mm-hmm. And it will be really interesting to see what that means they have to do structurally and both internally and how they operate with other businesses to be able to not be considered this Chinese app.
Mm.
I love the energy chatting about a video social platform has brought this, into this podcast studio meeting room.
It's become more of a geopolitical discussion.
Absolutely,
now.
It is fascinating. Yeah. And it is a company that it's one to watch closely.
Oh, 100%.
Really
interesting.
There's
lots of good stuff going on there. I mean, if you're looking for a job at the minute, it would be a better place to go to TikTok.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, massive scale. Anyway, on that note, let's move on to the second half of our podcast, which is Lauren finding out a bit more about what it is you're doing at Mail Metro Media. So first of all, as Digital Business Development Director, what is your role actually entail?
Okay, so my role is kind of in two halves, and we were talking about this before we started this podcast. The first kind of area is working with the assets that we already have, so kind of across the whole portfolio, what assets we already have, and are we maximising the commercial value from those? So whether that's kind of the contracts we have, the vendors that we're working with, the opportunities for syndication, or making sure that we're driving the most value out of those assets. And then the second half is kind of looking at new opportunities. So whether that's working with new technologies, whether that's kind of new data solutions, or kind of having proof of concepts and testing for all of the stuff that we've already discussed in the first half, how can we make sure that we're kind of trying to stay ahead of those changes that are happening in the industry, and also be very actively participating in kind of industry initiatives to make sure that we do kind of future-proof ourselves for the changes that will come through, whether that's kind of regulation or whether that's changing in what buyers want or how users are consuming content. So they're kind of the two sides of it. And I think that we've touched on lots of areas where I think there'll be kind of big trends for us and for the rest of the industry. So whether that's kind of the identity and regulation piece that we covered off at the start, and how the existing infrastructure needs to adapt to be able to continue to fulfill the digital ecosystem as it is, but also that convergence of multiple different sets of media and how we bring all of those together. And I think that for me is a really, really interesting piece, where it's no longer the silo of, well, this is what digital looks like, and this is what TV looks like, and this is what out of home looks like. And we're seeing more and more that though even just the buying platforms for that media have been brought into kind of existing SSP DSP relationships. So I think that will be a really interesting area for us.
Interesting. And obviously you talked about the fact that a lot of what we talked about today is like filters into your daily role and what kind of the big things you're looking at in the company more generally. What do you think are the exciting things that you can look forward to? Obviously, there's big news coming out that could change the face of the company and change the face of what it is you're doing. But what are the opportunities that you're looking at and going, that's going to be big for us this year? That's going to be something that we're really excited to explore further.
Yeah, I think so. One of the areas that I think is really exciting is content diversification. Ah. So how are we actually going to make different types of content? So whether that is, as we've just discussed, TikTok, or whether that is long form content and making kind of documentary style things, or whether that's working with things like initiatives we have in the US with Daily Mail TV. And how
I love
that
the
kind
Daily Mail TV. I'm a big, big watcher of it. But this is
Emmy-winning Daily Mail TV.
Daily TV, it's very interesting. I, by the way, I think it's a winner. I think you should be getting coffee mugs because I think they would sell pretty well. You know, product placement.
But that placement and commerce and that whole relationship, yeah, how that links back to all of our content is, yeah, something that's another really key area.
Do you think that this is an interesting, that you've just based the content diversification strategy is interesting, but do you think that publishers now have to consider themselves as content companies? Because there was a, in the past, we're the distribution, we're the channel, right? Like, put ads on page, we need to get more ads on the Daily Mail or the Wall of Shame or whatever. But now it's like, we create content, let's do content license deal. So do you think this decade we will see a shift in strategy and thinking around what publishers like yourself are, right? They're not just, you know, they're not just newspapers, they're content companies. They create content, whether it's political content or media content or, you know, fun sport content. There needs to be an almost a mindset change in how you perceive yourself, because as you say, it's not just the web.
I think that shift has already happened,
right? Okay.
In the It isn't a newspaper business. I don't work on the offline part of the business. I work only on the digital elements. And that has definitely, that shift in perception has already happened internally, in that it's a content creation. And it's then about, exactly as you say, like, what does the distribution look like? Is it on our own channels? Is it on other channels? We have lots of different relationships for kind of syndication out, but they will continue to evolve. And I think that's the bit that's super interesting, which is like, you almost have the opportunity, and like all publishers have the opportunity to play in any space, and it's for them to decide where they think it will either drive them a new audience, or it will resonate really well with their existing audience, or it opens up new markets for them. And that will be down to individual publishers to decide, like, what is their content strategy and how should they start to evolve in those areas. For us, I think that one of the kind of great benefits of our scale is that we get the opportunity to trial lots of different things, whether that's trialing with certain vendors or kind of like doing lots of beta testing with the major digital players, or whether it is actually like, well, could we do something that's really small in isolation and really works for this audience. And the great thing is that we have the flexibility and we have the resource in our business to be able to try all these different things to decide what will work for our audiences. And I think that's really exciting for us.
It gives you the, I guess, working for that kind of company, you have the scope to be able to go out and find these new things. And there's a, I guess, an excitement around the exploration that you can do, kind of what are the new revenue streams that I can actually go and find. Do you think that with publishers more generally, there is a bit of a scrabble round to kind of go, okay, well, I know that this part of my business is dying or slowing down, this part is stagnating, I haven't got the resource or capacity to go and find what the next big thing is, what is my new revenue stream? Do you think there's a challenge among publishers to work out, how do I diversify now?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, part of that is just having enough people to cover off all the conversations.
Exactly.
And to make sure that you're having that in a centralized way, rather than it be, oh, someone is having one conversation in the US versus someone who's having a conversation in London. Like, there's a whole kind of, but I think that's true of any business, trying to sort of have boots on the ground, but also have kind of an overarching strategy. It's finding that middle ground and having the right people having those conversations to pull it all together.
Mm. And what for you is going to be your kind of, obviously you mentioned new platforms. Where do you see those taking you this year, or maybe the next sort of like even 3 to 5 years? Because I guess it's all a long term thing. We've talked about lots of platforms today. Some of them might not even exist in 2 years. Some of them are only just starting out. How does that change the dynamic of what it is you try to do?
Yeah, I think video has always been massive for us. So I think video will be a key component, and that will It's not a pivot because it's not something that we've had to change to, but it will continue to scale, and that scale will look different depending on the platform. So whether it's long form product placement, TV style content, documentary style content, and that then lives within Netflix style streaming platforms, or whether it is more kind of like the opposite end, like we were just discussing with TikTok, it could be a whole spectrum. But I think the video will be definitely a key component of it.
Interesting.
And that is quite a, to your point on like traditional publishers, how they, you have to have a different set of people. It's a different skill set. It's not right. It's not editorial as you would have previously had it, but it is still that storytelling. It is still. And I think that's one of the things that publishers have been doing for a long time, which is trying to work out what works on those new platforms as they change, and also not kind of overextending into ones that might be flash in the pan or might kind of be of a short time frame.
Is the sort of streaming revolution being good for you guys? I mean, obviously BuzzFeed have got a documentary explained on Netflix, which is really good. 15 minutes, they take on a big subject and they do it really well. But is that like, is TV like the potentially big opportunity that you see? Like, I mean, I know that's always been there, but the proliferation of these streaming channels who are so content hungry and there's so much money. Amazon spends billions, Netflix spends billions. You know, you got the advent of other streaming platforms now as well. Disney Plus. I know they'll have their own content, but there's so much opportunity for good content companies now to build and create stuff that these guys want.
Yeah, I think the content and the licensing piece is one element of it, and that definitely exists. And kind of, I'd say it's the start of what it could look like.
Right.
But then also there's short-term opportunities around how do we join up on the data side? How do we make sure those audiences can be connected? How do we make sure that the profiles that we do have and the kind of knowledge that we have of online behaviours translates across to, especially in the UK where broadcast is such a kind of sewn up market, how can we make that kind of join up? There's loads of opportunities, but yeah, I think it will be an important part.
Excellent.
I think that is a good time to end this week's podcast.
I think it's one of the greatest podcasts of all time.
It's been brilliant, isn't it? Yeah,
of all time.
There's been ups and downs.
You can edit out that swear word at the beginning, Rodney.
Well, the one in the middle as well. So
which one?
We'll just mark. You said bullshit.
And now that's not really that bad.
I've just said it as well. Well, we still have to mark explicit lyrics when we publish it.
Really? Can I get a beep in there? I want a beep.
No, we're not.
Just before the Google beep.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not putting a beef in.
All right.
No, don't listen to him, Rodney. Thank you very much to our special guest, Lauren.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And thank you, as always, to Kieran.
Thank you all.
Coming in, showing up today.
Look forward to the future.
That has been this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast.